Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today I have a very special show for you. We're going to spend the hour talking with Ethan McCord. Ethan McCord is the GI, the former GI. He's the soldier that stood up in Iraq and was the soldier who was featured in the major collateral murder video, right?
Yeah, released by WikiLeaks, Collateral Murder.
Yeah. And basically you were featured, you were shown actually doing something that was unheard of and much needed, which was taking a stand and rescuing wounded Iraqi children, despite the overall move, the overall drive to just say to hell with it and let them die. And you decided you had to, as you said to me during when we last interviewed, you said, I got my humanity back. The Iraqi people gave me my humanity back.
Right.
So, Ethan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me again.
Yeah. So what? It's been a year. What have you been up to, man?
Oh, it's so much. I have actually been featured in a short documentary that was nominated for an Oscar this year. So I was actually here in LA back in February and went to the Oscars and walked the red carpet and sat with the movie stars for an evening. And we didn't win the Oscar, but, winning was actually getting nominated, just going through all of that and actually being nominated. We lost to Saving Face, which I wouldn't have asked for a better film to lose
All right, well, why don't you tell people, for people who don't know what the film was, why don't you just tell people a little bit about what the name of the film is and what it was?
Sure, absolutely. The film is directed by Mr. James Spione out of New York, and it is called Incident in New Baghdad. The film actually tells my story, my struggle with coming to terms with feeling used and saving the children that were shot by the Apaches in Iraq, July 12th, 2007. This whole incident was caught, of course, on video by the Apaches and allegedly released by Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks, who then WikiLeaks released to the public, and they named it Collateral Murder.
You know, one of the things actually just and this is going to be sort of a freewheeling interview, but one of the things that strikes me as you're talking, you know, the two names that you are, the two people involved in actually bringing that to the fore, Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, both have paid a very dear price.
Right.
You know, Bradley Manning still sitting in jail. And after a year of inhuman treatment, or two years of inhuman treatment, and Julian Assange just getting basically notified that he's being shipped back to Sweden, where he's going to be thrown
extradited
into prison. Yeah. So, what has happened with you over the last year, besides the film?
Well, I have received quite a number of death threats through former soldiers that I served with. They have also threatened to kill my children, to quote, wipe out my bloodline. I take a lot of that as false bravado, but I also am very overprotective of my family. Through the threats, I went out and I bought a handgun just to protect my home. I lived with these people. I lived with these people for 11 months in Iraq. I know what they are capable of doing. Even though they won't admit it, most of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder just like myself and can snap at an instant. And I would much prefer taking care of my family and being on the safe side than not. On the other side of that, I also think a lot of that is like false bravado. But here's the problem is that, especially with infantrymen, is here I am, I'm out here, I'm challenging their self-justifications as to why and what they did in Iraq. And I think we're having a problem with the self-justifications of soldiers nowadays. They're definitely running out of justifications as to why and what they did in Iraq. And I think that's one of the major issues as to why we are seeing 18 veterans killing themselves a day.
18 a day?
18 a day is the number, yeah, 18 a day. Monthly in Afghanistan, I believe the number of soldiers dying is 50 a month. And we have 18 veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars killing themselves daily.
So that's almost 500 a month.
It's an epidemic is what it is. And we're not killing ourselves out here because of we were doing great things for God and country. I mean, we're out here killing ourselves because of we're being asked to do horrible things and to live with these horrible things. And I think that the awareness needs to be raised for these veterans who are living through this. And I'm sure you've heard of the soldier who up in Washington not too long ago waterboarded his 5-year-old daughter for not learning her ABCs.
No, no, not at all.
This was out of Fort, of course, Fort Lewis McChord. But he returned from Iraq, and his 5-year-old daughter was unable to learn the ABCs, and he put her on the kitchen counter and was dunking her head into the sink, essentially waterboarding her because she wouldn't learn her ABCs. You know, we're having problems with veterans. I mean, the Afghanistan kill teams. The Staff Sergeant Jeffrey Bales, which I think is ludicrous. There's absolutely no possible way this man went out by himself and killed 16 Afghans by himself and then came back to the cop. It's impossible.
Huh. So what do you think?
Well, according to the witnesses who are, of course, not being interviewed by mainstream media, they say that it was an entire company that was out there.
Well, even if it was, you know, and frankly, even if it was one person, you know, that went out and did this, I mean, the horror of that crime was
absolutely.
Just, you know, and you really saw a sociopath that was in operation there mm-hmm. that didn't know the difference between right and wrong and didn't care, you know, and it's
right.
And they just went out and you kind of, you have to wonder, because I thought of you actually when I saw that, because I thought of what you confronted when you saw what was happening to the people that got shot in that incident in Iraq, and then that van when you came up on the van, mm-hmm. and you were confronted with a big question. Again, this is the point about humanity. You were confronted with a big question of, do you recognize the humanity of the Iraqi people or don't you?
Right.
You know, and do you recognize that this was completely unjust and was actually constituted in one, whether even if you were able to rationalize it exactly at that moment, objectively it constituted a war crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you basically said you were confronted with a choice, you know, and I wonder about, and you made the right choice. You said, look, and that's why you got your humanity back in a large sense.
Right.
You know, and you look at somebody like Bales who basically, I mean, look, there are probably thousands of Bales in the U.S. military.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's definitely thousands of Bales here's the one thing is that, you know, this every time something like this happens, the president comes on TV or the Department of Defense and says that these are just a few bad apples strained from the system every single time. But this isn't the few bad apples. The few bad apples are people like me who refuse to follow the orders to kill innocent men, women, and children. We're the bad apples according to the system. You know, this is the system in place. This is not a few bad apples strained from the system. This is how your system... This is how our soldiers are trained to act and react in a wartime situation. And, you know, I say that blaming the soldiers for this is like slapping a child because its mother's ugly.
Hmm.
You know, we have to – now, I'm not saying by any means that soldiers are not responsible for their own actions. But how about let's, as a whole, stop slapping soldiers on the back when they come home and saying you're doing great things for God and country – and thanks for protecting my freedoms when it's the last thing that they were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, they weren't protecting freedoms whatsoever for anybody. So let's stop slapping them on the back and saying they're doing a good job. And let's go after who's actually training these soldiers to do this, which is the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, the government. You know, you go to basic training and you're taught immediately to dehumanize every single person.
How does that work? How does that...
Well, especially in the infantry, you're trained to dehumanize other people in the army or in the military that are not infantry as well, because infantry is the best. We march to cadences like I went to the market where all the Hajis shop, pull out a machete and I begin to chop. Went to the playground where the Haji children play, pulled out a hand grenade and blew them all away. I mean, it's a simple dehumanization tactic that has worked. For the most part, if you get a 17, 18, 19-year-old kid who's marching to these cadences daily, it replays in their head over and over again to where they actually start to believe it. You know, there's people who lie constantly who really honestly, if you put them into a polygraph, they'll pass because they believe their lies. And this is what's happening to our soldiers. They believe what they're being told wholeheartedly. And so to them, they are doing the right thing when they go overseas and they kill these people.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Ethan McCord. He's a veteran of the Iraq War, and he's the GI who stood up and refused to do what was expected of him in Iraq, which was to deny the humanity of the Iraqi people and allow innocent children to lay in their blood and die. And basically, Ethan has been spending the rest of his life out there fighting against this and standing up around this. And
I have, yes.
Well, let me ask you this, Ethan, because, you know, as you're talking, and you're talking about all the, you know, how this actually happens, how this gets produced. You have to wonder, too, because you think of these things. You look at these things with the, what was the team? You talk about the kill teams, and you talk about the, you know, and then think about these things, the photos that came out of the people, of these GIs with body parts draped
over them. War trophies.
Yeah. And you know, and then, or the soldiers who were urinating on the dead. Mm-hmm. And you think about how does somebody get so twisted and turned that this becomes what they do. And then you think back, this is a continuation of when they started taking what they did to the Native American people, what they did to, you know, all the way up through it. I mean, the waterboarding that started in the Philippines, the way that in Vietnam, where they would actually, you know, they would assault women's genital organs, you know, and they would cut off ears and take babies out of pregnant women's uterus and stuff, you know. And this is, you think about what kind of savagery gets created and unleashed then. And then the idea that you should be quiet about that. You should be, you know, that whole buddy system that works in the military where you each have each other's back, which means covering up and justifying all the crimes that are being committed.
I don't think that a battle buddy is actually supposed to cover up war atrocities. I mean, I'm sure that in the military, that's what they expect. But I mean, for myself, me being a battle buddy was making sure that my soldiers didn't fire their weapons at individuals who didn't have weapons themselves. But as far as, you know, you have to kind of, they say war is hell, like that's supposed to be a justification and an end all to every atrocity that has ever happened in war. Well, war is hell, you know? And I think that right there is just it's just cheap justification of what you do in war. And does war turn good men evil? Absolutely. I saw good soldiers, good kids, who, you know, the majority of us went to Iraq with the beliefs that we were providing this freedom and democracy for this oppressed people. And we get over there and we are told that the entire population is the enemy. The entire population in Iraq was deemed our enemy. So we didn't know who our friends and enemies were. And This is I'm assuming the same concept that happened in the Vietnam War. You had no idea who your enemies were, and so we get over to Iraq, and then we start getting blown up on a daily. Your friends start missing legs and arms and being killed, and I think that you start to revert to this place of animalistic savagery. That's almost like a self-preserving technique that you're going to get them before they get you. And that's why a lot of soldiers, I think, started firing their weapons indiscriminately at civilians. Let's go to this Afghanistan kill team again. These are soldiers who were doing the same thing that was represented in Vietnam, I think, with the taking of the ears and the fingers. And they're holding up dead Afghanistan teenagers and holding them up and taking pictures like they were hunting deer. And this right there is, again, dehumanizing the enemy. You don't see people holding humans up and posing like it's a deer after a hunt. And these people were. And again, it shows that this is a way of dehumanizing the enemy and making these people unhuman to kill.
But don't you think that there's something more that comes into play, too? Because here's the thing. I mean, you didn't do that. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of, like you said, it's not like you're saying you don't hold individual soldiers responsible for what they're doing. I think you certainly have to.
Absolutely.
But the thing is even recognizing what they're taking up, because it's not just the, you know, and yes, war is hell and it does terrible things to people's heads. But there's an ideology that, as you were speaking about, when you're doing those cadences in boot camp and the whole idea, everything that gets pounded into you, including the mom, country, apple pie, and all this stuff that you're, you know, that you're defending. And this is, you know, look, America is God's country. You know, and that's what they say, you know, and that's it. And so the thing is you're fighting on God's side and actually frighteningly for a lot of people and very enraging for a lot of people too, is that the officer corps is actually consisted of a very large, thick column of Christian fascists,
mm-hmm.
you know, who believe they are and want to get their troops mobilized around. They are fighting for the reascendance of Jesus
right.
in the world, you know. And this is so you get this ideology where everyone else is just, you know, they're targets at best, and that's the most humane you can look at them. And then sure. then it becomes they're demons at worst who have to be wiped out. You know, this
they're
is,
Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, essentially, Muslims are a threat to Christianity. And we have to do everything we can to protect our religion, our faith, and smite them like the hand of God is basically the overall from Christians in the military. Mm-hmm.
And that plays over into the whole super patriot, the whole, you know, the chauvinist. I mean, look, you know, America goes all over the world thinking that, you know, and it confuses a hell of a lot of people, you know,
yeah.
around and both. And I think, you know, I'm very concerned by the fact that, you know, what happens is you see a lot of the atrocities that occur, yet you don't see that much resistance in the military, which is why somebody like you, when you step up and speak out and you know, both when you did it when you were in the military, mm-hmm. but then then there was a period of time where it was driving you crazy,
yeah.
you know, and you didn't say anything. And then you saw the collateral murder video and you went, whoa, that's me. You know, and then things became a little different. And then you see these things. And I've read some of these things you know, if you Google your name, I'm sure you're aware of the fact you get a lot of these battle buddies.
Yeah.
You know, who talk about, you know, there's one cat in there particular. And he runs all the stuff about what he would do to you. And mm-hmm. frankly, that concerns me a lot because it's not just the, you know, you can say, okay, it's
you're
empty
talking
bomb
about Doc Bailey. Obviously.
I can't remember his name, but
yeah.
it's, but the, you know, the thing is, you know, it's not just the fact that they're saying this. It's not empty bombast all the time. Maybe it is in some cases, but
yeah.
even if it is, it creates a certain atmosphere that is a very dangerous atmosphere, both in terms of you as an individual, but even in a bigger picture, in terms of intimidation and in terms of another way to enforce this kind of savagery and the savage mentality, the sociopathic kill for country mentality
right.
that's out there. You know, it's a very heavy thing, I think.
Yeah, and going to the threats that, you know, this guy is going to do all these things to me, you know. If I was to take every threat seriously and live my life always looking over, I mean, I look over my shoulder all the time anyways. It's just from being in Iraq and everything. But to really seriously worry about these people who are out there making all these threats towards me, I mean, I don't have the time for it. And, you know, I have my goals, my mission, which is, as I'm again this year doing, is stopping the recruitment of our youth in high schools. And I think that truly this is the only way that we're going to end the wars is by stopping the recruitment. I went to Compton High School today, and they did not have a peace action group in their school. And I said, let's start a peace action group right now. How many are with me? 17 kids raised their hands in this classroom, and they signed up, and we now have a peace action group in the works in Compton High School. This is the way that we're going to stop the wars, by ending the recruitment.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're having a conversation with Iraq War veteran Ethan McCord about his dedication to anti-war organizing today. I think it's really important to go and spread the message that you're spreading in terms of telling the truth about what you do when you join the military.
Right.
You know, because a lot of people they look at it as a way out of the ghetto, a way out of poverty, a way out
sure.
of misery, you know, a way to get sort of learn a skill.
Let's look at that right there for mm-hmm. a second. What recruiters use to recruit our children, the job skills. The truth is that you're three times more likely to not be employed when you leave the military than if you were to never have joined in the military. Because a lot of employers, if they know you've been deployed and they know that you have some sort of PTSD, TBI, or anything like that, they don't really want to deal with you. The homelessness situation with the veterans is through the roof, as well as the suicides. I think that all of these numbers speak for themselves as to why we shouldn't allow recruiters to take our children and do this. You know, one of my friends who I grew up with here in California, up in the Bay Area, is on my Facebook, and we got into it, and he said that recruiters are doing their job. They are salesmen. They are salesmen and they are selling a product. And I told them, I said, my child is not a damn product. And neither are anybody that I know. Their children are not products either. And I refuse to allow a child to go and get recruited into the military without being educated first. We're always educating our youth onto drugs and gangs and everything else. We're big on education. However, for some reason, when it comes to military service, everybody's tight-lipped. I'm out there, as well as Mike Preisner and Kevin Baker this week, and we're out there and we're going to every single school that we possibly can, so that way we can tell the kids, this is the reality of the military service. You know, this is the truth of military service is you're going to come home and you're going to be so jacked up, you won't use your GI Bill. I could use my GI Bill, but I can't. I can't sit in a classroom and take notes, because to me now that seems ridiculous. I tell kids also, how are you going to use your GI Bill when your arms are blown off? How are you going to do your homework?
Tell me this, too, because there's another aspect of this that comes into play. There's always another aspect.
Absolutely.
Here. And part of it is not being able to use a GI Bill, because the price paid for that GI Bill, not only for yourself, but for what happens to all these. I mean, look, they're talking now about 2 million people in Iraq killed.
Right.
You know, not officially, because the official figures are about a tenth of that.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a whole point of what you actually, you know, what you give up in terms of, like you talked about, you have to give up your humanity in order to really embrace this thing, you know, and that continues even afterwards, because you have to somehow justify what you did one way or the other. I mean, they still got Vietnam vets out there talking about, well, we're upset because we weren't greeted with warm and embraces and big welcomes when we came home. Well,
Would that have made any difference?
Yeah, well, you just participated in the genocide against the Vietnamese people.
Absolutely.
You know, and at a time when many, many thousands of GIs who were in active combat in Vietnam refused to do what they were told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was a whole big social movement, which is something that's missing today. You know, there's not that kind of movement. So when someone like you stands up, and beyond you, you know, whatever happens, whoever comes out, you know, that there's a certain amount of courage and conviction and refusal to embrace the horror that's being presented. Because that's what I was going to say is, look, one thing about ending wars, we have to think about this, because this country, you know, what it did to the Native American people, when it reached out and became a system that was actually going to go out and try to get its share of the world so it could exploit all the, you know, whatever, resources and the people in other parts of the world and make more profits, it went out and did it with very eagerly, you know, and very viciously. You know, and you look at all these wars that have been fought since then, and the fact that we're in so many wars today, including the drone wars, which is a way of, well, you know, worried about recruitment, we'll just build millions more drones,
right.
You know? And you have these idiots sitting over there in McLean or down in the, somewhere in the South, you know, dressed up in their flight suits and going in and sitting down in a 7-Eleven strip mall or something and running a video game, you know, and slaughtering people. You know, this is the kind of thing that they're doing. And so you really begin to question the whole idea, the whole system that's behind it, the whole way of thinking that's behind us, and the system that gives rise to that, too. So I'd like to hear your comments on that. And then I have a question for you, so I won't load you with 10 questions at once. But what do you think of that?
Well, I definitely think that we're moving towards a society that is desensitized from the killings. Look at the especially with the drone wars. I mean, look at Call of Duty, for Christ's sake. You're sitting here watching kids play Call of Duty that looks.
Tell people what Call of Duty is.
Call of Duty is the Xbox or PlayStation game of where you are a soldier in a first-person shooter perspective, who's running through. You know, some of them are in. There's actually one that's, I think, one of the newest ones that you're in Vietnam and you're killing the Vietnamese and running around. And one of them is actually you're in an Apache and it looks exactly like Collateral Murder. You've got the crosshairs and you're going around and you're shooting people. And, you know, it desensitizes people so much to the fact of killing. I mean, I remember as a child, G.I. Joe and Rambo, and, you know, I'm a product of the 80s. I mean, everything was military, 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 military. I ran around and played Red Dawn with my brothers. We were the Wolverines. And, you know, actually, the Wolverines and Red Dawn is one of the things that made me change my mind about the people in Iraq and what I was doing over there. here the roles were reversed. You know, if anybody's seen the movie Red Dawn, you know that we were attacked in Red Dawn by the communists, the Cuba and Russia, and a group of ragtag individuals, including Patrick Swayze. Of course, it's Patrick Swayze, but they pick up arms and they fight back after the invaders are killing their family members. And what do the invaders call the Wolverines? Insurgents. It's exactly what they call them in the film. So I'm sitting over there in Iraq and I'm realizing that we are the invaders, and everyone calling these guys insurgents and terrorists, I'm sitting there looking at them and like, these are the frickin' Wolverines. You know, why are these people being called terrorists when we're sitting here, we invaded their country, we shot his child, who was doing nothing more than playing soccer in the front yard. And when I go to high schools, I ask kids a lot of the times, I'm like, who here has a brother or a sister who's about 5 or 6 years old? And a lot of them do. And I say, now, if I came to your house in the middle of the night, kicked in your door and shot your little brother or sister in the face, would you thank me? Or would you pick up a weapon and try to kill me and kill everyone who looked just like me? And every single person says, I'd pick up a weapon and try to kill you. And that's exactly what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. They don't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us because we've been killing them for 10 plus years.
Yeah, very good point. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Ethan McCord. Ethan is an Iraq war veteran who became a dedicated anti-war activist. Ethan is also the soldier who was shown rescuing Iraqi children who had been severely wounded after being targeted by the U.S. military. Ethan was filmed by an Apache helicopter hovering overhead as the U.S. Army opened fire on the van containing these kids. Ethan went to rescue the children and in doing so defied the expected behavioral norms for U.S. combat troops. We're going to take a quick musical break now and be right back to continue our conversation with Ethan McCord.
Red and swollen tears tumbled from her eyes, while cold silver birds who came to cruise the skies send death down to bend and twist her tiny hands, and then proceed to target B, in keeping with their plans. Khaki priests of Christendom, interpreters of love, ride a stone leviathan across a sea of blood, and pound their feet into the sand of shores they've never seen. Delegates from the western land to join the death machine. And we send cards and letters.
Welcome back. That was Untitled Protest from Country Joe and the Fish. Couldn't be more appropriate. They slaughter people and we send cards and letters and prayers and good wishes. Yeah. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show and we're talking with Ethan McCord, the Iraq war veteran who came into the national spotlight when he was shown rescuing wounded Iraqi children in the collateral murder video first released by WikiLeaks. Since that time, Ethan has dedicated himself to do all he can to oppose the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, especially by going to high schools to tell the truth about what it means to be in the U.S. military. Ethan, let me ask you this.
We're talking about sort of the impact, and we'll get back to this. I want to hear more about what you've been doing in the schools and the response you've been getting. But I also want to hear something else. We've talked a little bit about the response that you got from sort of these continuing rabid vets and maybe active duty military as well, who knows. But there's also one of the things that's changed a little bit is there's been a growing amount of activity among vets of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And most recently, there was this one that I thought of you during this, because there was this one action in Chicago where they
the NATO summit.
Yeah, at the NATO summit when they threw their medals back. And it was meant to harken back to the day during the Vietnam War when all those vets got up and filled a cage with their medals, you know.
Right.
And it's very heavy that happened right now. What was your response to that? What did you think of that?
Well, I definitely think that the action was good. You know, one of the things that I worry about is that, you know, we're not winning anybody who's active duty by doing this. The ribbons mean crap. I agree with that. They, you know, I'd rather much rather have my humanity back than my ribbons. While I agree with what happened with throwing the ribbons, I don't think we were actually winning anybody over by doing that.
Let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that happens is a lot of times it's true. People in the military are blinded, mm-hmm. you know, to a large extent. And they come into, you know, in the past, in the, you know, again, if we look at, use as a reference point, which I don't want to do too much of, but use as a reference point, a period that was actually very good in terms of resistance in this society, the, you know, the 60s and the Vietnam right. years. And there, a lot of people went into the military already, you know, thinking, well, I don't want to be here, you mm-hmm. know, this is, and also influenced by this huge, massive social movement that was going on against the war and the uprising of black people in the ghettos and all these right. things that were going on. And which changed people's consciousness to a great degree. But there was also, even when you go in there and you talk to GIs that, you know, people, you talk to vets now who were like at Fort Lewis, for instance, and who took a stand against the war. It served as a lightning rod that actually gathered some people to it, but also forced questions in other people's heads. And one of the things I thought about in relation to these medals being thrown is that, in a way, that could really cause, you know, a lot of GIs to say, what the hell are they doing?
Exactly.
You know, and that's good because then they can look for the answers, you know, and the you know, that's something that actually, and the answers have to be out there, and people have to fight to put those answers out. And then you have to think bigger too, because it's one thing to talk about the GIs. It's another thing to talk about the message that's delivered to the rest of the world. All right. the Iraqi people who see these people throwing back their, you know, what was it, the world terrorism, you know, medals.
But they're
and all
throwing it at NATO.
Yeah, but that's, but you know, here's the thing. It's the symbolism of actually throwing the medals back and saying, I'm ashamed of these.
I get that. I totally get that. Mm-hmm. I do. There was nothing that you could have said to me while I was in the military before I went to Iraq that would have changed my mind at all.
Right. But here's the thing. What you did may have caused others to change their mind. You know, and this is the point, because you challenged people. And see, mm-hmm. and this is a thing. It's like, and again, I do think it's very important not to leave the people of the world out of the equation here, because that action said something to people of the world. And it said something about that goes along with everything you've been saying about why do they hate us? Well, they hate us because we're going over there and doing this stuff.
Right.
You know, and but then here are these ex-soldiers who are saying, I won't be part of this. You know, and then I do think that the fact that raises questions, it may not, you know, you're right. It may not immediately. And I'm not saying it's the 60s. It's obvious to anyone. The kind of upheaval that existed in the 60s doesn't exist now.
Absolutely.
It's reason for tremendous concern.
As much as all of us want it to be there, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, here's a question. When these guys come up, even the, you know, the hearings that they had, the Winter Soldier hearings, you know, very important in terms of what they said. And I know that they got a lot of, and actually I was thinking of that when I was reading that one cat on who was, you know, screaming and yelling about you. You know, there's a scene in that film that where one of them, they get a letter from this guy who this other vet who was actually, I guess, a battle buddy of this guy, mm-hmm. this guy who was in the film. And they're calling him all kinds of names and they're doing all this stuff and they're trying to, you know, basically throw mud all over him and then threaten him, you know, and try to intimidate him. And but the fact that people had to stand up and that they felt compelled, just as you felt compelled, because I'd say what you did in Iraq would not have most people, most of the soldiers in Iraq, I'll bet you anything, thought, what the hell's the matter with that guy? What is he, chicken?
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of thing, you know, and hey, he's selling us out, mm-hmm. you know, but you did something that changed things. For some people, for some GIs, and on a huge scale for people in the U.S. and in the world.
Right.
That was important. That's very important.
And but see, the difference with that is that I didn't do it to change anybody. I did it for myself. Mm-hmm. And I did it so that I can maintain my humanity. Because, there, you know, that's one incident out of so many that I stood by and was too chicken to stop. I mean, I watched a Bradley shoot an entire van full of children. And as the Iraqi police were sitting there pulling out the pieces of these children, you know, they're looking at us and shaking their hands like, what the hell is wrong with you people? And I'm sitting there looking at them and like, holy crap, what did we just do? There's plenty of times that I wasn't able to. I didn't know that that Apache was videoing me that day. You know, I had no idea. I did this for me. I didn't do it for anybody else. I did this because when I looked inside that van, I saw my own frickin' children. There was no race, religion, creed, nationality that differentiated my children and those children. And as soon as we as a people can start realizing that it is our responsibility to raise every single frickin' child on this planet, you know, we have to come together to raise the children of this world. And that's the way I look at it. And by no means am I saying that what the action that was taken in Chicago was wrong. I'm not saying that. You know, my whole thing is I just want to make sure that they were doing it for the right reasons. And I, you know, I know a few of the people, and I know that some of the people there did it for personal reasons.
I think the fact that it's been a long time coming. It got some coverage, but
yeah.
It wasn't all over the New York Times.
We need a mass action.
Well, we need both things, I think, because even though, like you're saying, you did it for personal reasons, but oftentimes when you step up and you do something for a personal reason, and especially when you were a soldier who, like you said, you went in believing all the hype.
Right.
And then you got confronted with this and you had to do something, as you said, to take back your humanity. At the same time, you're acting now, not just out of personal reasons, even though that may still influence what you're doing, but you're acting now because you think that there's a necessity for you to act to stop this stuff.
Absolutely.
You know? And I think that's what I know you're saying you support this, and I think it's important that your voice say that, you know,
right.
Because no matter what, you know, we could never tell what people's individual reasons for
this. Of course not.
But the fact is at this point, to say to people here and around the world and to other troops who may be looking at the bales in Afghanistan and saying, or the kill teams, and saying, that could be me.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell do I do? Is it right? Is it wrong? I'm troubled by that. I'm looking at it. And then here are these vets who are standing up and saying, it was all wrong. You know? And,
yeah.
And that, to me, has the potential for breaking through on some things, which is one of the things I wanted to ask you about.
I agree.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Ethan McCord. Ethan McCord is an Iraq war veteran who has dedicated himself to fighting against the U.S. war efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I wanted to ask you this. You've gotten some of these horrific responses from vets who were former friends of yours or vets who never even knew you but are outraged about what you're doing. Have you heard anything from any active duty military?
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of things?
I've heard from a few active duty members who think that what I did was right, and they stand behind me 100%. You know, of course, there's going to be the people out there who think that I did that I sold them out and that I, as they call it, a blue falcon.
A blue falcon?
Yeah, BF, buddy.
Okay.
You know, there's going to be those negatives, but the positive has far outweighed the negative. And quite frankly, I don't really give a crap about the negative because I know what I'm doing, and I'm not trying to be a hero to anybody. I'm trying to be, I'm trying to leave the legacy that I want to leave for my children. You know, I don't want my children thinking, oh, my dad's this like PTSD'd out crazy veteran who went overseas and just killed all these people. They can say my dad stood up for what he believed in. And that is exactly what I want my children to believe.
Have you heard from, and I know this is probably way out in the stratosphere here in terms of what's a possibility. Have you heard anything from any Iraqi people?
Yeah.
Really?
A lot. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Me. Last time I was here, I don't know if you remember, there was a crew from Amsterdam who was following me the entire time.
Yeah.
They made a film called Permission to Engage. And it actually, they went to Iraq and showed the footage to the family members of everyone killed on September 12th. And the mother and the children, and I've kept in contact with them also. I've gotten a lot of friend requests from people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Egypt, who have seen, especially my YouTube videos, and say, I have to, you know, I just want to, you know, pick your brain with this and you give me hope for Americans. And I said, but there's plenty of me out there. There's so many of me out there. You're only seeing one person because of this incident that happened with collateral murder that was widespread. I mean, it was disseminated all over the globe. But there's so many. There's so many organizations like March Forward and IVAW and We Are Not Your Soldiers that have groups of veterans who are out there. And, you know, we're out there. We're all out there. And there's so many of us. But it seems that it comes down to the mainstream media not really wanting to deal with us. I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and I just recently got on MSNBC. So it was, I was caught on camera on MSNBC, and they finally came to me, and, because they had actually asked me to be on quite a few times, but every time before, the day before I was supposed to be on, they'd cancel. And I was like, oh, well, the figures. So.
Well, that's interesting because, a lot of what they do in terms of this, you can see it in terms of, Bales is, as you said earlier, you pointed out earlier, not only the president comes out and says this stuff about the bad apple, but, look, Bales is this. He was, had a loose screw when he went over there, and he's just, all this stuff.
Yeah, just like Bradley Manning released this information because he was gay. Come on.
Yeah, right. Exactly, yeah. And that's the thing, though, is that they try to always, they do, the press is, it's the press is sort of an adjunct to the whole system. I mean, it's, they talk about, free press, but it's funny how you can pick up any major newspaper in the country and the front page invariably has the same major articles and the same opinions on it,
Absolutely.
And it's meant to shape and create public opinion in service of what's going on. And every now and then it's also a place where sometimes differences get aired out among the people who run things, but.
Right. Like with the New York article that was bashing Bradley Manning that I wrote a response to, I wrote an entire response and I picked apart this journalist's interpretation of Bradley Manning and I destroyed everything that he was saying about Bradley Manning, that, he was just a disgruntled gay soldier who was having a hard time with his boyfriend and stuff like that. And I said, look, Bradley Manning didn't do what he did. And he's not a hero to me because he had personal problems. It's the fact that he had personal problems and still chose to do what was right is what makes him a hero to me. And I will always stand behind Bradley Manning no matter what. And there's not anything that anybody can say to me that would change my mind on what that is because I read the chat logs. Whatever stated by Bradley Manning is the exact reason as to why he did this. He did this to create worldwide debate and reform, not to somehow give the information to our enemies, which is seeming that pretty much every damn country is going to be our enemy the way we're acting. We're the big bully on the block who keep punching people in the nose. And what do? We're always trying to ask why and rationalize what's going on. But it seems that in society today, especially with our government, the best thing for us to do is always apologize. We always apologize. But here's the issue. Every time that you go out and you apologize, the next apology, if you do the same thing again, makes it less and less ingenious. Oh, sorry, we killed 8 people with a drone today. We are deeply apologized for that and are doing everything we can to possibly stop this from happening. The next day, we killed 12 more people with it. We deeply apologize. We're doing everything. It just gets old. It's ridiculous.
It also reveals some truth, though, too, because it's sort of like reading a script. And basically, it reveals they're not really sorry. They're doing it as it's conscious
policy.
Not. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're having a conversation with Iraq War veteran Ethan McCord. Ethan was a soldier shown rescuing severely wounded Iraqi children who had been shot by the U.S. military. And the whole incident was being filmed by an Apache helicopter hovering overhead. This video became known as the collateral murder video when it was released by WikiLeaks, one of the earliest videos released by WikiLeaks. And ever since then, Ethan McCord has dedicated himself to fighting against the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't know if you saw the New York Times the other day, but they put out a thing about Obama and his hit list. For all these people who are so enamored of Obama, now he's got this hit list, and he's had it. And they talk about all the ways that he, from everything from Guantanamo, that he said he was going to close down, to drone warfare, all these things, to being able to detain people, you know, without trial for as long as he wants, keeping renditioning, all of these things, everything that he said he was going to do and everything that was written up and passed, like, say, around Guantanamo, actually had contained within it language that allowed him to keep Guantanamo, right, or allowed him to keep renditioning, or allowed him to have drone warfare. You know, this is, or detain people without trial. You know, this is the kind of thing that goes on.
Nobody wanted to listen to that, though.
But we don't. Oftentimes, we don't hear it either. We don't see it because it's a way it's put in there that gives them the ability to do this while they're selling the ice cream and cake to everybody else. Just eat your fill and you'll be fine. You know,
we have a saying for that up in the Bay Area, selling wolf tickets. I mean, mm-hmm. Here's the thing, you know, I don't really believe that it has anything to do with Republican or Democrat or Libertarian or any of that. There's, you know, the underlying problem is that our frickin' Congress is run by corporations. The corporations who have a hold, like KBR and Blackwater, who every time they get in trouble, they just change their name to a different thing and they go right back in. You know, these are the people who have a hold of what's going on, and they have a hold of the decision making that's going on in our country. And you know, like when President Obama was elected, and I was asked, do you have any expectations? And I said, I expect that nothing will change. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an important point, because even the corporations, I mean, and the corporations are all, they have a system, you know, they have mm-hmm. a system that basically determines, is built on and based on and determines the way things that are needed to survive by the society as a whole are produced and distributed and right. reproduced, you know, and this is the kind of thing. And they set up a whole set of relations, which basically, as you're saying, you know, a corporation exists for profit. The system overall exists for profit. And whatever they got to do to keep that profit coming in, they're going to do, whether it's having 8-year-old kids work themselves to death in mines yeah. in the Congo, or whether it's savaging the Iraqi and Afghanistan people and the people in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. You know, any of that. That's all. And then who knows where else they're going to go? You know, I mean, the stuff they did in Libya when they sat back and, you know, they talked, they basically said, look, we're going to, you know, Gaddafi's so horrible. And then they send in NATO and they send in their CIA and they do all this. And then they basically are waging their war there. The threat of war against Iran now. How much further are people going to allow this to go? But before they recognize that there's actually a system at work here that needs to be gotten rid of. That's the thing, right. I would say, you know?
Well, yeah. And you know, I personally am sick and tired of people being afraid of the government. The government should be afraid of us. I mean, if we were to all get together and stand up, I mean, there's no stopping us. There's no freaking stopping us. But everybody's so freaking afraid to get up and do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so afraid to step outside of their little comfort bubble, step out of their little homes and say, you know what? I'm sick of this. I'm sick of children in other countries who are no different than children here in the United States being killed in my name. And I'm not going to stand for it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us back to people like you. No, I'm serious. It does. It brings us right back there, because it's, you know, this is the point that in order for other people to do it, there does have to be people who will stand up and do it first, mm-hmm. you know, and who will stand up and crack some heads open. Because, look, we don't have a response that's commensurate with the horror that's going on. We right. don't, you know, and we don't have millions of people in the streets. You know, every time a war is announced, we have more and more people pulling themselves deeper and deeper into their little spot in the matrix, you know, and getting a little bit more comfortable and, you know.
Locking one word window in their house.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the scene. I mean, even, you know, you look at this thing that happened with Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. you know, the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida, people who stood up around this.
Right.
And that was one thing that happened in Sanford that I think nobody really, it should have happened, and it needed to happen a lot more around the country, that more people needed to do what the people in Sanford did, which was to stand up. And even there, it was mainly the black people who stood up. We're not going to take this anymore. Mm-hmm. But when I looked at that, and I look at the horror of that, and then I've been thinking about this a lot. And then I look at, a friend calls me this morning and says, did you see what happened in Milwaukee? And I said, no. And they said, Darius Simmons, Google. And I did, a 13-year-old black youth standing with his mother, killed by a 75-year-old white guy who claimed he took his things and wouldn't give them back.
Good God. See, I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah. And then they put his mother in the cop car and questioned her for hours. They arrested his brother. This is the kind of society that we're living in. And you know, what you did and what other people like you did is so important in terms of cracking people's heads open and helping them to see that there's a need on whatever front to stand up against this stuff. Because if we don't, we will be crushed. Humanity will be crushed.
Right.
Well, Ethan, on that note, that's a tough place to end the interview.
It is. You got me like all.
Well, say what you want to say, brother. If you have.
No, it's just I didn't know anything about the Milwaukee thing today. I've been out here, you know, nonstop, mm-hmm. going to schools all day and everything, and well, since I got here, and you know, it's one of those things that just really, really upsets me. I mean, you know, I don't know. Not too many people know that my daughter is half black, and I just went through something like that something of racism at her school by another black child. And I don't know, it's upsetting. It was ruining my daughter. And I had to step forward and go to the school. And because the school wouldn't do anything, And I finally went in there and I stood up and threatened the principal that if they didn't do something, that I would. And they moved the bullying child out of the class. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it just, my daughter was so afraid to just say something about it, you know, because, you know, I don't know why she was so afraid, but we, you know, our children are afraid to say stuff like this. And it's just, it's
well,
pathetic.
That's the point. Yeah, and they're afraid. And you know, look, bullies and the promotion of bullyism, mm-hmm. you know, I'm very deeply convinced that this has a big connection to the whole thing that we talked about a little bit before when you were in the whole way from the moment, particularly guys, mm-hmm. from the moment people are able to, and young children, male children, and I'm sure it includes female children now too, because of the whole role of women in combat and all this other stuff. But there's a link there of creating, how do you create a society of people who will do whatever they're told to do, no matter how heinous and inhumane it is? How do you create that? And it starts with the promotion of things like these video games that you were talking about, mm-hmm. as well as the idea that bullying is okay. It's okay for a kid to kill a kid out here in California because he perceived that this young gay kid was hitting on him. You know, so he thought it was his right to come into school and blow the young gay kid away. And what happens to him? You know, he's not held responsible. Or the guy in the college student in New Jersey. When he filmed his gay roommate on a date,
yeah,
you know? and then he says, "Oh, I didn't do anything wrong." Well, yes, you did, because what that leads to in this society, it terrifies, you know, somebody who wants his private life private, you know.
Well, our society is a society of entitlement. We feel entitled to whatever the hell we want, mm-hmm. and forget who's going to be affected by it. You know, we want to be fulfilled in our ways and our thoughts immediately. And, you know, as soon as we start thinking about other people around us is when we're going to change. But until that happens, unfortunately.
We're talking with Iraq war veteran and anti-war activist Ethan McCord. And this is the Michael Slate Show. Ethan, one last question.
Yeah.
Okay. Where to now, Ethan?
Well, I'm going to be here in LA all week.
But in the bigger sense of what you're going to be doing.
I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing. I never know. I go where it takes me. I've actually been writing a book very, very slowly. But I've actually, what I've found to be extremely helpful to me is writing poetry. And I've written quite a few poems. In fact, a month ago, I was sitting in my garage. My family was gone, and I had a gun in my mouth and was getting ready to... In my life, when my good friend Kevin Baker called me out of the blue and talked me down, and then right after that, I wrote down my thoughts, and I would like to share that with you today if I could.
Definitely. Go ahead.
And what I'm hoping with this poem, and I'm going to want to get it out there, is that you know, it helps people understand what veterans go through and dealing with PTSD and... how it affects us and how it affects our families. All right, this is called A Soldier's Disease. When your prayers for mercy seem to fall on deaf ears, when the agony is so intense you can no longer shed tears, when your face shows the age well beyond your own years, that's when you'll be. When sleep is the enemy, afraid of what you'll awaken to be, when just leaving your home seems to be a harrowing feat, when images of dead innocence seems all that you see, that's when you'll be. When the lies you once believed now poison any chance of a new start, when the anger is so unbearable it feels like your mind's being ripped apart, when knowing your family fears you and choose to closely guard their hearts, that's when you'll be. When your only chance at survival rely on people who shoot blank stares, when the prescriptions to help you sleep at night only increase your nightmares, when it seems you're all you have and even you've lost all self-care, that's when you'll be. When your shaking hands and voice sometimes make words not quite come out, when you reach for your handgun or knife from every odd noise in your house, to when that handgun becomes your prescription and you place it in your mouth, that's when you'll be like me.
Ethan McCord, thank you for coming in today and joining us and for sharing everything you shared with us. And
thank you for having me.
Always enjoy the conversation, brother.
Yeah, me too.
Take care of yourself. Well, that brings to a close another edition of the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. You know, as we start to wrap things up, I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian's book, some food for thought that is very appropriate for our show today. It's not uncommon to hear these days from government officials and others that only 1% of the population is in the U.S. military, but that this 1% is fighting for the freedom of the other 99%. The truth, however, is this. That 1% in the military is in reality fighting for the other 1%, the big capitalist imperialists who run this country, who control the economy, the political system, the military, the media, and the other key institutions, and who dominate large parts of the world, wreaking havoc and causing great suffering for literally billions of people. It is the freedom of these capitalist imperialists, their freedom to exploit, oppress, and plunder, that this 1% in the military is actually killing and sometimes dying for. Again, that's from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. And in the weeks to come, we are going to be featuring stories from a recent opportunity I had to join the Basics bus tour as it rolled through Sanford, Florida, bringing Avakian's vision and work out to people and helping to build a movement for revolution. So stay tuned for that in the coming weeks. I want to thank my guest today, Ethan McCord, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Let's go out now with a little bit more from Country Joe and the Fish and their song, An Untitled Protest.
The oxen lie beside the road, their bodies baked in mud, and fat flies chew out their eyes, then bathe themselves in blood. And superheroes fill the skies, tally sheets in hand. Yes, keeping score in times of war takes a Superman. The junk crawls past hidden death, its cargo shakes inside, and soldier children hold their breath and kill them as they hide.